It's time for TWiT, This Week in Tech. Leo's out today. I'm Mike Elgin filling in for him. We have the technologizer, Harry McCracken. He's here, along with CNET's Lindsay Turrentine and Katie Benner from The Information. We talk about major moves by Apple, including Beats, HealthBook, smart homes, and what's going to happen at WWDC this week. Plus, Google's crazy car and Microsoft's crazy smartwatch. It's all coming up right now on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 460, recorded June 1st, 2014. Drones delivering diapers. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Stamps.com. Start using your time more effectively with Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. To get our special offer, go to Stamps.com now, click on the microphone, and enter TWiT. That's Stamps.com, and enter TWiT. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. Follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by Personal Capital. You'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear picture of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/twit. And by Carbonite, whether you have one computer at home or several at your small business, Carbonite backs up your files to the cloud automatically and continually. Plus, access your files anytime, anywhere with a free app. Start your free trial at Carbonite.com. No credit card required. Use offer code TWIT to get two bonus months with purchase. It's time for TWIT, This Week in Tech, the show where we talk tech with some of the smartest people we can find. My name is Mike Elgin. TWiT's news director, and I'm subbing for Leo Laporte, who's off today, and we have a fantastic team of brilliant people handpicked by me personally, starting with the technologizer, Harry McCracken. Welcome, Harry.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
Now, before we introduce the other people on the show, I want to ask you about the technologizer, because this site is now reborn. You've been famously with Time.com for quite a while, bringing a lot of street cred to that publication, in my opinion. And now you're branching back out on your own. You're re-energizing the technologizer. Tell us what you're going to do with that site.
Well, I'm kind of going back to basics. I was at Time for a little over 2 years, and technologizer was part of Time.com. So it was a tiny island in an extremely large ocean of content. And I decided to leave Time recently. And the cool thing was I was able to take technologizer back with me, and I put it back on WordPress. I mean, one of the cool things about being a journalist today is you can work for a large media company, but you can also reach a lot of people on your own. So I put together a new design. It's not going to be completely different from what I did at Time or what I did when it was technologizer as a standalone brand, but I'm going to try even less hard to kind of be a news destination. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of sites such as CNET and The Verge and others who are better for news than I can ever be on my own. But I think I'm pretty good at analysis and insight. And so I call it slow-cooked content. I'm not going to try to do 40 posts a day. I'm going to point people towards good posts elsewhere. And I'll do relatively little content, but hopefully of high enough value that people will notice it.
And that's really one of the uber trends that's making tech journalism and journalism in general so great these days, because people like you are leaving the big mainstream publications and they're branching out into sort of these kind of startup mode operations, ranging in size from, you know, The Information — we're going to talk about The Information in a sec — technologizer, and then doing the more in-depth reporting. And it's getting to the point where I think technology journalism is actually becoming one of the best forms, the highest quality forms of journalism. It's also — there's a lot of garbage out there, let's face it, but there's such good journalism these days. So I'm really excited about that. And the truth is that people don't go to Time.com and say, I want to go to Time.com because they have the best technology coverage. They go, I'm going to go read Harry McCracken. Like the individual columnists and analysts are the brand these days. And so, you know, it's great. You're going to bring your audience with you, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what you do.
And an awfully high percentage of them, when they go to content, it's because their friends or people they trust told them about it on Twitter or Facebook or Google+. So while Time was a great place to be, I feel like the entire web is the front door to Technologizer if my content is good enough.
Absolutely, and it will be, I'm sure. I've been following you for a long time. You and I go way back to the PC Magazine wars.
The old magazine days.
You and I were both competing against PC Mag, which was the 800-pound gorilla. But anyway, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. Also joining us today is Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief of CNET Reviews. Lindsay came all the way from slightly south.
From Berkeley.
Yeah, Berkeley.
Just a little ways.
And so what have you been working on lately? You've been in the business for a while, and we've had you on Tech News Today a bunch of times, and you are fantastic.
Thank you.
On that show. You seem to know everything.
Well, that's really my job. I have to know everything. We're working on a lot of exciting things. Some of the most exciting stuff that we've done recently is launched CNET en Español close to a year ago, getting close to a year ago, and it's growing and growing, and now is the largest tech site in Spanish.
That's fantastic.
In the U.S., which is really exciting, has been a fun project, and we're doing a lot of really interesting stuff about the connected home. So we cover appliances already in a big way, and we have this big facility in Kentucky where we do that. We're doing some really interesting stuff that we're going to be talking about soon. So.
Yeah. I bet in the sort of home automation world is really about to take off, and I think that it's really going to be launched in the stratosphere tomorrow. And we'll talk about that later in the show. But that's really exciting that you guys are all over that, because that's really going to be a major, major thing that all of us are going to be talking about.
Yeah, it's a very exciting time.
All right. Well, welcome to TWIT.
Thank you. We
also have Skyping in all the way from San Francisco, California, a few miles south, Katie Benner, who is a reporter for The Information. Welcome, Katie.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, you're with one of the entrepreneurial poster children of the new age of technology journalism, The Information, launched by Jessica Lessen. And how is that going for you guys? You seem to be cranking out some pretty awesome stories and making a lot of, sort of getting a lot of tension and generating a lot of scoops. What's it like to work for one of these entrepreneurial tech journalism startups?
You know, actually, it's really, really great. The pace is incredibly fast, because not only are we reporting on news, it's changing all the time, and the tech industry is so innovative and changing all the time. As anybody who's ever worked at a startup can tell you, the actual business itself seems to become a new company kind of every 4 weeks. You know, you grow and you learn, and you're always incorporating new information and new ideas about how to run your business. So this is incredibly good. It's a good boot camp for anybody who really wants to understand how to make the media industry a better place and more profitable, et cetera, et cetera.
Now,
and we're writing exciting stories. We love it.
Yes, you are. And you you personally have a background in financial and business journalism. Is that right?
That's right. So I was at Fortune Magazine for 7 years covering Wall Street. So it started out as kind of a fun beat, actually much like covering tech today is, where it's exciting and things are changing a lot. And you just hear about new, growth. And then suddenly the financial crisis happened and it became this extraordinarily fascinating thing to look at, you know, to re-examine all the assumptions that people had leading into 2008 and late 2007. And, you know, the things that people had missed because they were just awash in growth and optimism about what was happening on Wall Street. So this feels like a very interesting time to be covering tech. There are some similarities for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a fascinating time, and really enjoying what you guys are doing at The Information. Well, let's launch into the show, shall we? Let's start with the wackiest story, I think, of the week, which is Google's funky little clown car. Harry McCracken, what do you think? Why did they actually trot out a car that has no steering wheel as a way to make people feel more comfortable about self-driving cars?
Well, I was kind of fascinated by it, because a couple of weeks before that news came out, they had their first big event for their earlier self-driving cars, which were converted Lexus SUVs, which had steering wheels and brakes and everything. And so I thought I was up to date on what they were doing, and then it turned out that actually, no, they had concluded that that was really not going to work as a model for this, and they had been secretly building a car from scratch to be self-driving, which I have to say, I haven't been in that yet, but one of the things that was comforting about being in the Lexus was because there were two Google engineers in the front seat.
Licensed drivers, yeah. What a concept.
And they frequently explained to us that the whole idea was whenever the car came into danger or something where you kind of did not want your car making any decisions, no problem. There was somebody at the wheel who could take over in the blink of an eye and steer you through it.
And, of course, these cars are going to have – they're going to build 100 prototypes, they say, and those prototypes will have steering wheels and brakes, you know, the kinds of things that you want to be in a car. And the video, I thought, was kind of disingenuous in a way. It has a single button. So in this particular prototype, you push a button and it goes somewhere. And you push a button if you want it to stop, if a squirrel runs out the road or something like that. And it's like, well, wait a minute. How do you even tell it where to go? Like, what? How, you know, I understand that you can do this in a parking lot, but it just seemed like they didn't really raise the basic issues of how this thing works. They just showed how cool it is for people getting excited driving around in a parking lot. Lindsay Turrentine, what do you think? Was this, yeah, I mean, they're obviously excited, but...
Well, this is Google's way, right? To just start with an idea and kind of just throw it out there and say, start thinking about this, start to think about what this could be like and get people's imaginations going. And I think, you know, Google is, at its very base, it's all about the data. So yeah, they're seeing a future in which data drives your car, you tell it where you want to go, and it just does all the thinking for you. I think that this is, there's a very long list of cultural problems that Google has to get over, and they know that, so they're trying to start early. But the thing that I've been thinking about a ton is that, like, let's say that this gets used in a small capacity, right? And we start using these for essentially Uber.
Yeah.
You call one and it takes you across the city, not on a 50-mile trip, but mm-hmm. just to the grocery store. But what happens if you do need to take over at some point? Yeah. And if this became a huge cultural norm, how do people get the hundreds of hours behind the wheel that they need to be able to take over safely when they have to?
Yeah.
Because I don't think we're all going to be in self-driving cars in 10 years. It's going to take a lot longer than that.
Yeah, well, I tend to think that that it's going to be a kind of gradual thing. We're looking at super cruise control, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
We've already got that to a certain extent. The high-end cars, rich people are much safer than poor people because they can buy one of these high-end cars. And if, you know, if somebody slams on the brake in front of you. In fact, Vic Gondotra, of all people, did a commercial for one of the big car companies. I don't know if you remember that, where he said, oh, this car saved my life because I wasn't paying attention. And the car in front of me slammed on the brakes. And the car automatically slammed on the brakes.
Yeah, for sure.
And so that kind of thing is actually easy to do relative to the self-driving car thing. Because the self-driving car thing is all about maps and sophisticated maps. Yes, Google has completely mastered Mountain View, California.
Oh, it's great in Mountain View.
Yeah.
Petaluma, probably not so much.
Yeah. And, you know, we're talking about a couple of thousand, you know, miles of road that they've mapped. And, in fact, there are millions and millions and millions of miles of roads yet to map. And, of course, lots of companies are working on this kind of technology. All the car companies are working on it. I personally think that this car has two purposes. The first is to show that you can't just slap electronics on the roof of a Lexus or a Prius. You need sensors down below. You need the whole car purpose-built for self-driving if you really want to do it right. And the second thing is, I mean, look at this thing. It has a face on it. I mean, who can stay mad at this car? It's like, you know, they're trying to make it so warm and fuzzy that when they go to, you know...
This is it's the opposite of a, you know, the sort of muscle car experience that we all get advertised to us all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Google's trying to go after. Like, hey, we're not trying to replace your amazing driving experience. This is functional. It's something that'll make things easier for you and it'll be fun. Like, if you're not a person who loves driving or you're a person who needs convenience and you want to just text in the car, you can do that safely because you won't be driving.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, anything that the self-driving car does, you run over an old lady, you hit a dog, whatever it is that you do, whatever it is the car does, whatever it is Google's algorithms do, frankly, you're going to be liable. You're not going to, you know, when these things hit the road, you're not going to be able to sit there and drinking scotch and playing backgammon and just like not even worry about what's going on.
Bummer.
You're going to be liable. I know. That's the bad news.
I think this is the data comes into play, because I think that one thing that all of the self-driving car people are thinking about, Google especially, and then even some of the automakers, is how do we make this the norm? And I think the way they do it is by getting the insurance companies on board. So the insurance companies are very, very concerned about data. And if data can prove that it's cheaper and safer for the insurance companies, they're going to encourage more and more and more automation in vehicles. And so we'll be pushed along as a public to accept technology that we might feel is kind of icky right now, just because it will be cheaper. I saw a really fascinating speech given by Dan Gere, who's over at InQtel, and he's done a lot, you know, he's just sort of one of these guys who thinks about big tech problems. And he was like, there will probably be a day someday, not now, but not too far away, where none of us will really be able to afford to own and drive cars that don't have some level of sort of extreme automation, because the insurers will demand it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Google wants to make this friendly car, and it's really cute, and they want us to convince us that we want to drive it, and it's, and the scariness, that sort of weird sci-fi Orwellianness of a self-driving car, we can get over it with the face. But in the background, they're also, you know, thinking very hard about how to not just make us feel better about it, but to force us to do it in other ways.
I personally want a self-driving car that has a sort of ventriloquist dummy-looking Johnny Cab kind of face there that's like talking to me and being crazy. I think that would make it all worthwhile for me personally.
Yeah, would you like it to also speak out?
I want a sofa in my self-driving car.
A sofa? Dog bowl?
Yeah.
Sure, yeah,
I was very
absolutely
disappointed to see that there wasn't more comfortable seating in this thing.
I know, put a bed in there or something, you know, put a totally, you know, a hammock or something in there. That would be great.
You know, the biggest, like, practical thing that I keep thinking about the self-driving car is, gosh, I work all the time. If I had a self-driving car, I wouldn't ever have a chance not to work.
Right.
Like, right now, driving is when I just don't work.
In fact, for you, I think you should get a self-driving office. Because imagine if it was, you know, you could go to, like, you could drive to the other side of the country to attend a trade show or something and slave away the entire way. A desk in there.
Nirvana.
Yeah, it'd be fantastic.
Oh, it's weird to be in a place where I can't do email and whatnot, which is what a car is for me.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, remember when airplanes were like that? Back,
right.
You know,
yeah,
that I used to love flying because it was like, okay, nobody can call me. Nobody can reach me on, you know, email or whatever. Those days are gone. Well, Google's up to a lot more than just self-driving cars. They have, according to reports, rumors, whatever you want to call it, they are working on Android TV to replace Google TV. Harry McCracken, what's the difference between Android TV and Google TV?
Well, the rumors are a little fuzzy. I mean, it sounds like Android TV, it plays up the Android brand, which is, you know, has lots of momentum of its own, and B, gaming is a big part of it. So that's a little bit reminiscent of what Amazon is doing mm-hmm. with Fire TV, which is a TV box, but one which is reasonably serious about gaming. And I mean, depending how you count this is Google's third, maybe fourth attempt to come into the living room with a device, because there was Google TV, and there was Google TV 2.0, and there was the Nexus Q, which was mm-hmm. that magic 8-ball-looking thing, which I think they gave up on before they actually had anybody paying for it.
Did anybody get that except Google I.O. attendees?
They gave it out at Google I.O., and then they sort of slowly decided that maybe it was not going to work after all and gave up on it. Of course, I mean, really, they're only, I mean, depending on how you count, there are, I think, either two or four companies that have succeeded at TV boxes. Those companies are Roku, Apple with the Apple TV, mm-hmm. and probably Microsoft and Sony with the Xbox and the PlayStation, which are both used hugely for streaming video. And other than that, there have been dozens, if not hundreds, of TV boxes which have come and gone over the years without really having any impact.
Chromecast has been
Chromecast, actually.
Very successful.
Yeah.
And it's limited, but it's... But it's
I guess Chromecast has been successful. I mean, I think they managed to sell a lot of them. And I'm kind of curious how many are actually in use, because I know an awful lot of people who were like,
"Right,
this is incredibly cheap. I'm going to buy one." And how many of them stayed in use? I'm not sure.
Yeah. So it seems to me that one of the fascinating things about these reports that we're hearing, again, all this information is not something that Google has announced, and it's something that I think some of us are expecting at Google I.O., which is not for some time. When is Google I.O.? June?
End of the month.
End of the month. That's right. It's June already. The end of this month. So
June Sanity.
Almost a month. One of the big differences between this and the Fire TV is the Fire TV is a product. You go to Amazon.com and you order one, and they send you a box, and it has gaming, and it has apps, and it has some other things that are associated with your Prime account. Whereas this is a platform for other people to build a box, for other people to build a TV with this stuff built in. But what they have in common is a strong emphasis on games. So does anybody think that Google is going to become a powerhouse in gaming?
I think that Google wants to set itself up to be a powerhouse in gaming if that opportunity arises. And it wants to have an opening into everything. I also think that this is Google's way of I am pretty impressed that they keep trying this after the Google TV, you know,
fiasco, try and try again.
But the difference between the two, or at least the rumored difference, is that Google TV tried to marry the traditional television and then the streaming television experiences, and this is just the latter, right? And so it's really opening up a platform. If you can get people in to watch streaming TV seamlessly, and then once those games start to come over the internet and become more powerful, there's already that sandbox for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And at Google I.O. last year, you were there. I don't know if you went to Google I.O. last year, but they were talking about, you know, using Google Plus as the sort of communications medium for their coming game platform for Android. And I wonder how that's going to happen. They, you know, whether that it's going to be Google Plus, whether it's going to be YouTube.
Well, the latest rumors are that maybe they're moving forward, they're going to be less aggressive about Google Plus being the platform for everything, and maybe saying, you know, Google has all these services, and we're not going to. Sorry, Mike. I know you like Google Plus.
I do.
We're not going to shove Google Plus into the face of people who don't necessarily want it.
Yep. Well, yeah, I mean, that's essentially my, you know, I guess it's somewhere between an assumption and a sort of an analysis of the situation, which is that Vic and Dotra really drove the Google Plusification of everything in the company. And from within Google, what that means is that no matter what division you were in, no matter what division you were in charge of, Google Plus was more important than you. And you had to change your product for the objectives of Google Plus rather than your own objectives. And so YouTube and so on. And I think that there's got to be, and again, I'm not a fly on the wall. I don't know what's really going on in Google, but that's got to be why Vic and Dotra left to a certain extent. He burned every bridge there was because he was the guy, you know, going around forcing everybody to do stuff they didn't want to do. And so, yeah, I think that's the days of forced integration that's widespread and aggressive are definitely over. And it doesn't affect Google Plus at all. I mean, as a social network, who cares? Those things were all for the theoretical benefit of other Google properties.
It might help Google Plus, given that among people who don't love Google Plus, it doesn't have a great reputation, partially because people think of it as something being forced on them.
Yeah.
If Google Plus succeeded because it was good, which it is in a lot of ways, it might be good for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Google is also having an interesting time in Europe these days because they often clash with the Europeans over a variety of things. Things like Street View, car, and so on. The most recent clash is over the right to be forgotten. So some guy in Spain had some financial trouble years ago, and then fast forward, he cleaned up his financial act, and he got to the point where he was, you know, he was doing fine, and he didn't have, you know, all this debt and so on. But when you searched for his name, you could find, you know, he looked like a financial basket case, and it harmed his reputation. So he took it to court, and he won. And what that meant was that Google has now required to enable European users, because of one Spanish judge, by the way, to enable European users to submit a proposal that they have their information, the link in Google, in Google search engine, in every search engine, to be removed. So this affects not only Google. Google lost the case. They were the defendant or whatever you want to call it in a lawsuit. But they now have to comply. They have done so. So this happened some time ago, and now they've actually put up their form saying, if you want to remove your link, here's the form, fill it out. And thousands of people have done that. Now, this is a controversial thing. Katie Benner, what do you think of all of this? I know you have a point of view on this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think initially it feels like a very good idea because I think that people are trying to find ways to take back control of their online identity. I mean, it's why things like Snapchat are successful, or things that disappear so we don't feel stuck with everything we do online. But it gets into a very tough territory of essentially sort of censoring the web. So I think Google, if they decide to take down a link, they're also going to note that a link has disappeared and how many links did they take down? What does that mean? Who are they rewriting the history for? Is it useful to have some of this information available? How do they decide? This is just such tricky territory. So I think it will be, actually be a lot harder than people think for this to be successful.
Absolutely. I mean, does anybody in this Council of Wisdom support the European decision, this idea of right to be forgotten? Is this something that it has value that outweighs the complications?
I think I've been thinking about it a lot because, I mean, we all probably have links we'd like to take down. And I don't think it's a good idea. For one thing, I think that there's an entire industry that will grow up around it that will be, you know, you'll find a consultant who knows the right language to mm-hmm. use in the form and all of the right tactics to take to get certain things taken down, regardless of whether it's a good idea or it's really something that is, you know, a link that's no longer relevant. And it doesn't seem like there are very good guidelines yet about what that, what makes a link something that deserves to be taken off of Google.
That's one of the crazy things about this is the European regulators have constantly told Google, Google, we don't trust you. We don't trust you with your Street View car. We don't trust you with your, you know, with you listing your competitors on your search engine. We think you're favoring yourself. They go on and on about how they don't trust Google. And they say, and then in this ruling, they say, but you know what? You're in charge of deciding what's a good link, what's a bad link, what's a relevant link, what's an irrelevant link. That's all up to you, Google. Good luck.
Yeah, that seems crazy. I mean, it seems like if that's going to happen, and maybe there's a future in which there's a way that we get certain things taken down so that, you know, public interest in something that is untrue doesn't drive untruths to the top.
Yep.
But there needs to be legislation around mm-hmm. that. It can't be up to Google.
Right. And to me,
I was just going to say there are also companies already that exist that do reputation scrubbing online. And of course, I mean, what the EU is saying is you shouldn't have to be like a really wealthy person who can hire reputation.com or one of these services. But this is something that already exists.
Yeah, absolutely. But one of the things that's really the worst thing about this, and let me frame this in the way that sort of reveals it for what it really is. What they're asking Google to do, so there's a beautiful situation that exists. We have an internet, right? It exists. We have search engines to help you find the things that are on the internet. So what this ruling does is says, okay, Google, we want you to lie. We want you to have your search engine not reflect the actual internet, but to reflect whatever's left over after everybody who has the resources, the time, whatever, to scrub it. And by the way, this is only for Europe. So to me, Europe is going to have an increasingly inaccurate search engine. And Europeans who are savvy are going to find ways around it. They're just mm-hmm. going to use the American version of Google mm-hmm. or some other version of Google. And in fact, this is what people in China already do. This is what you do when you have a censored internet. You find, you know, you use various tools which are freely available to get around what's there. And then it's another digital divide, isn't it? Because the tech-savvy people, the knowledgeable people, the educated people are going to get the real internet. And then the average person is going to get a censored version of the internet. It's an awful state of affairs. And I think Europe needs to revisit this and not just allow one Spanish judge to essentially wreck the internet for an entire continent.
Yeah.
And who decides
needs
to be scrubbed?
Well, Europe. this is very European. This is the same, you know, the EU, they regulate like the way that a tomato can look before it goes to the market. I mean, there's such an amazingly rule-bound, kind of hidebound place. So it's not entirely surprising.
And Mike, you're right. They sort of have been, at war with Google for many years over all kinds of stuff. And I think it may not entirely be a coincidence that Google is this large company headquartered in the U.S., mm-hmm. which has so much impact in Europe. And there have been all these attempts to create the European Google, none of which have really taken off.
That's right. And they take a different tact, and the tact doesn't really work. For example, there was some years ago, the French government has these cultural divisions or whatever you want to call them. And they were freaking out that Google was digitizing all the books and sort of kind of becoming this powerhouse in the future of digital books. And so they wanted to do their own. And it flopped. And, you know, that kind of stuff is hard to do by committee. You need billionaires to do that kind of thing. You need billionaires with Google Glass and Vibrams and private jets to do these things. You can't just do it by fiat. Well, we're going to talk about Apple. It's going to be a huge week for Apple. And there's lots of facts and also not so big of facts, rumors, if you might call them, about what Apple is going to be announcing at WWDC tomorrow. But first, I want to tell you about Stamps.com. Stamps.com is one of our sponsors today. And you know who goes to the post office and waits in line at the post office? Other people. if you have stamps.com. Going to the post office, slogging your way through traffic at the end of your workday, and then getting in line with a whole bunch of people just to send something or to send a package or whatever is just a terrible idea, because stamps.com will let you do all the post office stuff at your house. You can, and especially if you have a small business, you want to do whatever it takes to make your business run efficiently. And if you want to be efficient, waiting in line at the post office is not the way to be efficient. It eats up valuable time you could be spending on growing your business. So you need to go to stamps.com. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, and using what you already have, your own computer, your own printer, and then just hand it to your mailman. It's that easy to do. Join the 500,000 small businesses that use stamps.com and never have to go to the post office again. There are no long-term leases, no hidden fees, no expensive inks, nothing fancy. Stamps.com can give a small business a more professional look. So right now, use the promo code TWIT for our special offer, a no-risk trial. It's a $110 bonus offer that includes a digital scale and $55 free postage. So don't wait. Go to stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click the microphone at the top, type in TWIT, that's stamps.com, and type in TWIT, and you will thank stamps.com. It's a fantastic service. Well, Apple is in the news. They, of course, are doing WWDC, and I think, Chad, don't we have an early look at, you know, people are wondering whether they're going to launch a watch or not. We've got this early look at a promotional video. Roll it, Chad.
From the very beginning of time, man has continually asked one question.
This might not be what official.
What time is it? Today, we at Apple will answer that question. It is time for the iWatch.
We found users constantly reaching for their phones to check the time, and that is the worst. So we figured, why not just strap it to your body?
Introducing our magical new product, the iWatch.
Now, not only can you check the time, but you can check almost any other alert that your phone could push to it. Wow.
The iWatch uses its built-in
this guy's a great voice.
4.0 technology to wirelessly communicate with your iPhone. This way, you can answer calls with ease, even when your iPhone is in the other room. Syncing your iWatch to your iPhone happens all in the background with our iSync technology. All you have to do to set this up is pair your existing iPhone with your iWatch. Make sure the confirmation code matches, bump them together, then input the 16-character passcode into each of the devices. It's really that simple. Repeat after every charge.
We have taken this iSync technology
sounds like a pretty good product.
To go. You can respond to text messages without your phone leaving your pocket. Resume your latest ebook with the flick of a finger. Catch up on the latest news headlines pushed directly to your iWatch.
The design that went into the iWatch.
Suddenly he's Johnny Ive.
Unparalleled. It's hard to believe that we could even fit a battery into this thing, but we did. And it will last you one entire hour of standby. You have never looked so attractive to the opposite sex. Yeah, it's that good. You can even use it when it's plugged in. You can charge it, listen to music, and sync it with your iMac all at the same time.
Gaming has never been more fun. Play your favorite games from your iPhone or iPad right on your iWatch. Every existing game is compatible? We've even added support for your made-for-iPhone controllers. Never be away from Minecraft again.
But there is one more thing. The iWatch comes with a built-in GPS-aware pedometer. We take privacy seriously, and that's why we've granted a live stream of your location to the NSA. Stop complaining. You love the attention.
Hey, guys, hope you liked that video.
So,
that's only slightly more silly than a lot of actual smartwatches which exist today.
That's right. That's right. And speaking of which, everybody expects Apple to launch an iWatch of some kind, a band, something. They're going to do it tomorrow?
No.
Turn time?
No. They're not.
Are they going to even mention it?
I don't know. I mean, I think that they're going to talk a lot about iOS 8.
Yeah.
And
we've
iOS 8,
posters.
I would assume, contains some hints or some direction. And there's going to be something that we can sort of see in that experience. And some of the other apps and software that Apple will be talking about, they're going to be The rumor is that Apple will be launching a health book app that brings all of your various sensor-based health kind of data into a single
like
app.
Like Passbook, maybe?
Yes, very much like Passbook, but for whatever you're tracking on your smart watch. So I would assume that there will be some hints in there, and I know that the Developers Conference program has a lot of the program, the later program, a lot of the sessions, the names are still blacked out. So there will be something, but I don't think there's going to be hardware tomorrow. I really don't. I think they're really focused on developers this year.
Okay. Harry, what do you think? What are they going to talk about tomorrow?
I mean, I think that a new version of OS X and a new version of iOS are a given, and that's a lot to chew on right there. It sounds like Health Book is real. Mark Gurman, who writes for 9to5 Mac, he's one of the few Apple reporters who, if he reports a rumor, you can't have 100% confidence he's right, but he's probably right. And he's written an awful lot about this stuff. I would expect some hardware, but probably not anything revolutionary. There might be new MacBooks. It would be nice to have a MacBook Air with a Retina screen someday. That would be nice. But people always think that Apple rolls out huge world-changing hardware devices at WWDC. And they forget that the original iPod was not at WWDC, the original iMac wasn't, the iPhone was not, the iPad wasn't. It's like the second or third device in that category they announced at WWDC, and I'd expect something along those lines tomorrow.
They don't want to steal attention from a major hardware rollout, and they don't want to mess up their supply chain either, right? So unless they're ready to sort of hit the ground and start selling something immediately, they're really unlikely to do it.
Which they usually don't do in the summer. Anyway, I mean, they did it with the iPhone for a while, but the iPhone has slipped into the fall. And this is an event for software developers. And if you are a software developer and you write for Apple stuff, there's nothing you care more about than the next version of iOS or the next version of OS X.
That's right.
And you don't care all that much, usually, about the specific hardware that it's running on. Unless it's something like a Retina display or an iPhone with a larger screen. Those kind of things do affect you, and you care about them.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about the coming spaceship campus that they're building, I think it's the current deadline on that, and of course they're already tearing up the ground and laying the foundation for that and so on in Cupertino, is that they have an underground bunker where they're going to do all their announcements. And so we know they're going to launch, you know, iOS 8 because we've seen the posters already. What's the name of the conference facility in San Francisco where they do this?
Moscone
West. You can just walk in there. You know, they can't, like, keep the public out of those. But the underground bunker is going to allow them to summon journalists within short notice, 2 or 3 days maybe, and then they'll be able to go on any schedule they like. They don't have to book it. And, you know, Moscone, you have to book probably, a year or two in advance and so on.
And those schedules, I mean, people will see that there is a mysterious event happening at Moscone West on a given week in June.
That's right.
And even if it doesn't say Apple, people often can figure it out.
It's literally impossible to keep that kind of information secret.
And Apple already does that, actually, at their campus. When they have a smaller event for journalists, they'll just bring people in. They have a facility.
A little theater kind of thing. So that'll be interesting. One of the, you mentioned Mark Gurman. Mark Gurman broke the story this week that Apple's discussing iPhone payment service. Now, he doesn't believe this is going to be a topic of a discussion at WWDC. They're talking about a payment service. So what they're doing is they're talking to retailers about having a way to use your iPhone as it's a credit card. Now, Katie Benner, this is a kind of a no-brainer for me. I've been writing about this for a long time that, you know, when are they going to do this? They have phones that have fingerprint readers on them. They have iBeacon, which is an indoor location system that's perfect for indoor retail. They themselves have innovated indoor retail stuff at their Apple stores where instead of going to a cash register, they don't have cash registers. They have people with blue T-shirts. And so you just walk up to the blue T-shirt and you buy whatever you want. You walk out and they email you your receipt or whatever. That's how Apple wants to remake, I think, the world of retail. And they have everything they need to do it. And the one thing that they have that nobody else has is 800 million credit cards. They have 800 million iTunes accounts that have active credit cards associated with them, which makes them, to me, that makes them the number one company that has the potential to dominate this kind of retail. Katie Benner, what do you think this is going to happen when they actually roll out some kind of mobile wallet system?
I mean, I have no idea when it would happen, but I think it solves such a big problem for the retailers, that I don't think it would be very hard for a company like Apple, if they chose the right retail partners, to make this happen. Because at the end of the day, we have these phones that we can go online, but we're not necessarily shopping or buying online. There have been a lot of studies on this. Nobody wants to input all of that information into that tiny, into all of those tiny fields. And so if you can make shopping as easy as it is to, you know, with your thumbprint, buy an app from the App Store, that would be great. And if you think about the Apple demographic, it tends to be pretty well healed. So if they were working with, you know, the Neiman Marcuses of the world, or you know, name your retailer who really wants to have to move goods online, stores that simply just do not right now. We don't do a lot of mobile shopping. It would be a perfect solution.
Yeah, we had Mark Gurman on Tech News today this week and talking about the story. And he was pointing out and emphasized, and also emphasized it in his article, that it's actually a really big problem, because each of these retailers has its own back-end system, and the Apple system would have to be compatible with those systems. So they have to go on a chain-by-chain basis. So as he points out, they're going to go for the big high-end chains, you know, the Neiman Marcuses and so on. And they're not going to go for the Targets, and they're not going to go for mom-and-pop shops either. So they're going to have to start it with the big chains, establish what would amount to a standard, and hope, presumably, that the rest of the world sort of retrofits what they've got to support Apple when this and if this works. But it's a fascinating story to a certain extent, but it's also kind of a boring story, because this is inevitable. Apple, I believe, is going to do that, and if they didn't do it, they would be morons, because it's so lucrative. You know, there's so much money involved.
They need to do it soon, because they still dominate market share, you know, for any single device anyway.
Yep.
But that has the potential to wane a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. As these become commodities, yeah. and a lot of people switch to Android, and there's so much choice out there, that if Apple doesn't figure it out right now, and get it out there with the next iPhone, I think that then it's in trouble. So now's the time.
Absolutely.
I think it's been smart. They've waited. Apple often does well because it swoops into a category after other people have failed. And like Google Wallet has not really gone much of anywhere. Square had a really cool app, which I think they've actually discontinued, just because it's hard to get traction with these things, partially because credit cards are actually a really well done way to make payments easy.
People are comfortable with them.
Credit cards set the bar high, and it's not easy for a phone to be better than a credit card. It's actually quite difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, it truly is. And I think that one of the things that, to your point, Lindsay, that Apple is going to do to sort of deal with the fact that hardware tends to become commoditized, and the competition is very intense, and the markets are very price sensitive, is this purchase of Beats. Now, right off the bat, was this a brilliant move or an idiotic move? What do you think?
I think a lot of people think it makes no sense at all. I actually think that it's kind of a no-brainer, because what Apple does is it moves through these sort of pipelines. It'll launch a very glossy, high-end product for the well-heeled, as Katie said, and then over time starts to do it in more colors, starts to do it in smaller capacities. You saw this happen with the iPod, right? Like, there was this huge, beautiful, expensive, fancy brick that then got smaller and turned into the Nano and a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
So Apple is approaching that with the iPhone, and is now, you know, has multiple models and may have even more in the future. And it's becoming a commodity product that is easily paired with headphones. And it makes sense to put it together with a brand that is really widely loved with a lot of shoppers, even if we all kind of know, or those of us who read about it, that and we test all these headphones, that Beats headphones are they're just not the best for quality. They're not, but they're the best for brand, and Apple loves that.
Yeah. Mm. And you wrote
also,
about this.
I think that,
yeah, go ahead, Katie.
Oh, I was just going to say, Jessica Lesson, my editor at The Information, she wrote a great piece also saying that one of the things that Apple has to do, because of the commoditization effect on the phones, is that they have to kind of keep things new and cool and make people want to come. And so by bringing Jimmy Iovine on board, they have somebody who can do sort of amazing deals with the record labels. And who knows? I mean, that could be, who knows what form it would take? It could be free music or the right to share music or something else we don't know in terms of in the entertainment space. But he is a very good deal maker. He's worked with Eddie Q for like 10 years. You know, they've known one another for a long time. He could be a good cultural fit there. And that that would actually bring to Apple sort of an intellectual property and a steady stream of great entertainment that a lot of other brands don't have.
As Eminem would say, you forgot about Dre. Is he a good cultural fit with Apple? I won't make you answer that.
So, please.
So, you know, here's my view of it. From where I sit, which is far away from Hollywood, as far as away as I can get, there seems to be that the music business has had two big shifts in its business in the last 15 years or something like that. The first is iTunes and the iPod, but the iTunes model of selling songs individually, digitally. And this has a positive benefit for the music industry and what they considered a negative benefit. The positive benefit is people are actually paying for music instead of stealing it, which is super easy to do. And the negative business is that people are not buying albums. I mean, I remember when you'd go to a record store and you'd buy an $18 CD. And you only wanted the one song, but $18 was the price to get that song. And that was a model that the music industry really seemed to love. So Steve Jobs' iTunes model was a nuclear bomb in the music business, where everybody used to get rich selling songs. The second one is called the 360 deal. This is something that hit around 2007 or so, which is that everybody realized, because of digitization, music is worthless because there's no scarcity with music. You have a digital file. It's just you can download it a billion times, and it's the same file. It's very difficult to impose scarcity for the purpose of imposing revenue associated with that. So they came up with these 360 deals. Instead of going to a superstar, a musician, and saying, okay, here's the record contract. We're going to make this much money. We're going to make platinum records, and you get this percentage of the music sales. They instead go, okay, here's the deal. You're going to promote this, and you're going to sell this, and you're going to have you co-brand with that, and you're going to have this concert thing, and that's the deal. Forget about the music.
T-shirts.
That's right.
So, at the end of the day.
That's right. And so the poster child for this concept of the 360 deal, who's probably done it better than anybody, is Lady Gaga. And her original business manager actually said that music sells everything except music. In other words, music is a great marketing vehicle, and so let's use that. And that's the new model. And Jimmy Iovine has been personally involved in that whole recreation. So the two people most associated, maybe the three people most associated with transforming and evolving the music business, are Steve Jobs and Jimmy Iovine, and to a certain extent Lady Gaga and her business manager and so on. So I think that to a certain extent iTunes Music is the real prize here, and although it doesn't exist now in terms of having the 360 deal stuff, they have been working on getting Beats Music to the point where that's the 360 deal service. In other words, while everybody else is trying to sell subscriptions to streaming music, I think that Beats Music has been working on a system where that's the place where musicians and artists can sell everything except the music. You give the music away, even,
right.
It's to a certain extent. But then, you know, you sell it. And, of course, Beats has been at the center of this. If you look at what Lady Gaga has been making money on, it's been headphones and concert tickets and all these things that have nothing to do with music. So I really think that's what it's all about. They bought somebody who's like the Johnny Ive of music business, right? A special person who's super knowledgeable and irreplaceable. And if he doesn't come with Apple, he's going to work for somebody else, probably Google or somebody like that. So I think that has a lot to do with this whole thing. You know, Katie Benner, I don't know what the future of music is going to be, but it's going to involve very cheap music and very expensive headphones.
Sure.
You know,
I'd agree.
Yeah. And, you know, and if you look at how they've been selling Beats, it's been like, you know, there's a Lady Gaga version of Beats and there's this, that, and the other thing. And I think that's really the future of what Apple is going to do. And Apple wants to be at the forefront of that. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I mean, no matter what you think of the quality of Beats products, it's one of the few consumer electronics brands that's been created in the last 10 or 20 years that matters. Mm-hmm. And it went from not existing to dominating a category amazingly quickly. And it sort of feels now that, like, Beats has been around forever, even though I think it's about 6 years old.
That's right.
Almost nobody's done that in a long time.
That's right. And the conventional wisdom is that you can make Beats for $15 to $17, sell them for $200.
Yep.
And they own 65% of the so-called high-end headphones market. I mean, what's not to love?
My kids don't, they don't really know of any other headphones.
Yeah.
I mean, they just go straight to it.
That's right.
And that's what you have.
And why? Because it's associated with celebrity, and they really want the music. And, you know, music fans really want to be into the bands and the singers and the artists and the, and so on. And there's a hardware component to that, apparently.
Well, there's a design component to it, too. I mean, I think it's worth not forgetting that Apple, more than any other electronics manufacturer, cares about the design ethos, all their products, and Beats is just like that. I'm not saying they have exactly the same design or the same approach, but a lot of the money that you're paying for is for industrial design and for the colors and the shape and the fact that, you know, you want to be seen in the airport wearing these.
Yeah. Although, oddly enough, I mean, all of the Beats products to date have been designed by this guy who used to be Johnny Ive's boss at Apple, and already they've said that that company, Ammunition Group, will not be designing Beats products moving forward, and it'll be intriguing to see who does design them and whether the look and feel changes at all.
Yeah, they need help on multiple fronts. One is the design, and Apple can help with that. And another one is they need help with Beats Music, because signing up for Beats Music is really clunky and really horrible. I tried to do it over the last couple of days, and I tried to get in on this AT&T deal so you can get like this family plan, five people for $15. It's a great deal, but trying to actually make it happen is very, very difficult, and so Apple might be able to help them with that. Well, another area where Apple is hoping to sort of create new business is around home automation. And home automation is super, super exciting. We talked about what you're doing in home automation at CNET. And what Apple is doing, according to the reports, is really not that earth-shattering, is it? I mean, already, if you go to Kickstarter, you look around at what's really happening in home automation, Apple's already kind of at the forefront to the extent that people create apps that run on iOS first and Android second. And so they're already kind of a accidental leader, and they're trying to get in front of the parade a little bit. So, but
what's
still,
going
I think,
on here?
Well, Apple is prepping a platform which is supposed to come out with at WWDC tomorrow, and they're talking about some APIs and just sort of a kind of a lightweight getting in front of the parade that already exists for home automation and giving home automation creators a simpler way to embrace Apple's coming platform for home automation.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a huge opportunity. And one of the things that every time somebody from CNET's on a panel about home automation, one of the things that we end up talking about is the fact that there are so many opportunities out there, but you don't want to have a separate app for your vacuum and for your light bulb and then another app for your thermostat and then an app for your smart lock.
Which is exactly what it is where you are today.
Which is exactly where you are today if you're even ready to sort of invest your time and money in a pretty young category. And so what Apple wants to do, I think, is just create sort of a, you know, passbook kind of style. Let's wrap it all up into a simple interface. I think it's kind of, as an aside, I think it's kind of interesting that Apple, which sort of created this, there's an app for everything, you know, millions of apps out there, is now in a position to be being like, well, you don't really need, maybe you don't need so many apps. Let's try to kind of get them corralled into a manageable space. But the other thing that Apple has going for it here is that it has a little bit of a head start with some of this home automation because of its low power Bluetooth in every single phone. Not all Android phones have that or other phones. And so Apple's already in early with some of the smart locks. And if they can sort of keep all of the third-party developers and manufacturers thinking of Apple first, that's another reason to buy into the Apple ecosystem, because it's just going to be in a tidy package. And so if you're a person who's going to go out and buy a thermostat and buy smart lights and buy a vacuum that you control with your phone, then that's sort of an easy choice.
Yeah. And Apple was the first to support Bluetooth Low Energy, Bluetooth Smart. It's got multiple Bluetooth 4.0. There's got a bunch of names. But Apple was the first to put that into a phone, the iPhone 4S. And since then, every phone, tablet, laptop has supported Bluetooth Low Energy. Now, just about everybody does. The other thing that they have, Harry McCracken, that is really, I think, an underappreciated resource is iBeacon. Because if you remember, Bill Gates built a revolutionary house years ago, and the way his house worked was you'd put on this little badge. You'd say, welcome to Bill Gates' house, and you'd get a badge or this pin or whatever it was. It was a little, I guess it was RFID or something like that. It was some kind of radio thing. And as you walk through the house, or so I've heard, he hasn't invited me over yet for some reason. you can say, oh, you know, I like Dr. Dre music, and everywhere you go in the house, Dr. Dre music would follow you, and your lighting preferences would follow you around. That's totally great with iBeacon. You could, you know, that's how you want home automation to work. You want to walk up to the thing and have the porch light go on and the door to unlock and, you know, have it know where you are.
Yeah, I mean, iBeacon has very quietly been very important in retail and things like stadiums. That's how a store or a stadium knows where you are and is able to push stuff to your phone in a way that, you know, actually does maintain your privacy because they only do it if you already have a relationship with them and have given them permission. And I think there are potentially a lot of parallels to what Apple might do in the home because iBeacon is mainly the fact that all the Apple devices support Bluetooth LE and Apple worked on standards and stuff so that other companies can sell the Beacon equipment in stores and be confident it will work with Apple devices. So Apple doesn't necessarily have to build enormous amounts of stuff on its own.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe all it does is it makes its devices the best platforms for other companies to build home automation on,
yep.
which they already sort of are already, even without Apple having done too much yet.
And I think that iBeacon is a seriously underappreciated or misunderstood or, you know, it's kind of below the radar. People don't understand how it works. For example, people don't seem to know that Android supports Android.
Yes.
So if you're an Android phone, and a beacon is really no big deal, and it's also seen as a sort of an NSA spy thing that sort of reaches into your phone and doesn't do anything of the kind. iBeacons are, to the best of my knowledge, incapable of receiving information. They simply broadcast.
Right.
Here's where I am,
I'm here.
That's right. And then the app is the thing that goes out to the internet if the app has developed that capability. The app is the thing that knows. You know, your beacon XYZ, beacon XYZ is in this particular location. The beacon doesn't even know where it is. It just knows who it is. And so, to a certain extent. So, it's a really fascinating technology. And one of the things that's most fascinating about it is that it's cheap. You can put beacons all over the place. A small business can put 10 beacons in and it costs them $100 or something like that. You know, so it's a pretty exciting technology. And I think it's really underappreciated for home automation and a no-brainer. I'm also curious about when the Googles and the Apples and the Amazons are going to build home automation into their TV set-top boxes. Seems like an obvious place.
It seems so. If I think, and this is just pure speculation, but if Apple is actually developing a television, wouldn't it make sense for them to start with one that's sort of small and beautiful in the way that, you know, a Mac Pro screen is, or you've got the sort of Retina, and then all of this home automation technology built right into that interface, into that television. So the first place you would think of putting that is in your kitchen, mm-hmm. or some place where you would automate, or you would already go to sort of check in and see what's up and who came in the back door when, and are my back porch lights still on, and all of that sort of built into a sort of a smaller screen that's really beautiful and something that you want to be part of the decor of your home. It might make a ton of sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in just a sec, we're going to look at the latest outrage by the NSA and what they're harvesting now. It's going to be exciting. Can't wait to talk about that one. But first, I want to tell you about Audible.com. Now, Leo Laporte always says that he's been an audio listener for a long, long time. I think I was an Audible.com customer before he was. I think I signed up in the year 2000. Believe it or not, when Audible was actually a hardware device, you were in high school, Lindsay. It was actually
it was
a hardware device that you would buy. It was this weird teardrop shaped thing, and I remember I actually demoed it to Regis and Kathy Lee back in the year 2000. And ever since then, I've been an Audible.com listener, and it's a fantastic service. Obviously, Audible has 150,000 titles to choose from. It's the world's largest selection of premium audiobooks and spoken word content. And to me, it's a no-brainer. Stories are an oral medium until very recently, and to be read to by a professional actor, to me, just is a source of joy and wonder and enables me to do the dishes and still learn something. And I really love it. Now, we have a special offer for This Week in Tech. We're offering a platinum plan from Audible.com. This gives you two free audiobooks right out of the gate and two book credits a month. That means basically you can, on average, you can download two books under this plan. And it's a great deal for people who really get a lot out of these books. You can get a free subscription to the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times daily audio programs. Take your pick. And if you want to get more details about the Platinum plan, go to audible.com/twit2. That's audible.com, twit, and the number 2. And, you know, there's a couple of new books that just hit in the last couple of days that I wanted to bring our attention to here. The first is Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era by James Barrett. Now, Leo Laporte interviewed James Barrett on the most recent episode of Triangulation, and this piqued my interest in this book. This sounds like a fantastic book, and I haven't downloaded it yet or listened to it yet, but this sounds like a really, really fantastic book. And, Chad, can you play play the sample there so we can take a listen?
Being suspicious of AI was painful for two reasons. Learning about its promise had planted a seed in my mind that I wanted to cultivate, not question. And second, I did not doubt AI's existence or power. What I was skeptical about was advanced AI safety.
Sounds pretty awesome. I, for one, welcome our new artificial intelligence overlords and can't wait to listen to this book. So let's look at another book that to me is a source of fascination, and I'm going to get this on audible.com. It's called The Man Who Knew Too Much, Alan Turing and the Invention of the Computer by David Leavitt. And this, of course, the life of Alan Turing is one of fascination for multiple reasons. He was just a genius as a child who is also in some ways not so bright as a child. He's one of these kind of idiot savant children, grew up to become an amazing code breaker. And of course, he was a homosexual who was persecuted for that. And I think he was recently pardoned or something like that by somebody. Anyway, it's a fascinating story, and I hope they do a movie. But in the meantime, The Man Who Knew Too Much is an awesome Audible.com book. And so these are the kinds of things that you get at Audible.com. And I recommend that everybody sign up if you don't already have a subscription. 14 years I've had at Audible.com. And that is why I am such a towering genius. Well, that's why I have fun doing the dishes, at least. Well, NSA is harvesting something new. The gift that keep on giving, the Edward Snowden revelations, just keep coming from... I guess they all come from Glenn Greenwald, ultimately, who is the person to whom Edward Snowden leaked these documents, and he's trickling them out to keep the information high. But basically, the NSA, as turns out, has been harvesting millions of pictures every single day. They harvest, and a great thousands of them are sort of facial image recognition quality. And apparently, according to the latest revelations, they are gathering these pictures, they're putting them in their database, and what they're going for is they want a database that enables them to essentially take a picture from a security camera, run it through their system, and say, that's who this is. It's really quite stunning. How much, you know, how many hard drives do you have to get at Best Buy in order to store millions of pictures downloaded every day? It's just incredible.
Well, the government already has tons of pictures of us stored because the State Department has all of those passport photos. And I think that they're not saying whether they're intermingling what the NSA is doing with those passport photos or not.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it would be silly to say that this is inherently a terrible idea. I mean, if they do it the right way, this sounds like it could be a really good way to find people we want to find. And the big question is always is how many other innocent people might get caught up in it.
Yep.
And I think the other question is...
It's already being done in Lower Manhattan. I mean, after 9/11, New York City, its own counterterrorism unit, created a lot of initiatives, and one works with businesses all over Lower Manhattan, basically, because all of these businesses have security footage, and they are able to access that security footage, and they do store some of it, and they're basically looking for people who they need to find. And so this isn't unheard of. You know, this is a more extreme example, but it's not unheard of.
Yeah, I think whether or not there's an extreme concern about this practice has to do with where the images are coming from. If the images are coming from the open web, well, those images are out there. And, you know, you put an image of yourself on the internet, it's pretty likely that somebody's going to look at it. We know that that's the risk we take when we publish selfies. The question is, like, if the NSA were intercepting these and pulling them off your phone... and they were private images, that's a completely different situation. But so far from what I've read, I haven't seen that come up.
Well, I mean, you know, the revelations that started with one of the first revelations, this first or second one, was about PRISM, which is about, you know, the NSA essentially finding ways to tap the internet connections coming and going from the likes of Google and Facebook servers or data centers. And that stuff all has pictures in it. I mean, if you look at Facebook alone, you know, I don't know how many pictures are uploaded to Facebook every day, but it's just it's an astonishingly high number. And if they're getting the data, that data includes pictures. I mean, I think that's what we're talking about here. I think it's kind of obvious, really, in retrospect, they're not just going to skim off the text. I mean, you might think they would simply because of the scale of this thing, but they're not worried about scale. There's an interesting controversy within Utah over the NSA's Bluffdale, Utah data center, which is supposed to be just massive. And the scandal is that there are there are political actors within Utah state politics that are opposing this kind of mass surveillance, and they want to shut down the NSA by cutting off their water. A data center like that needs massive amounts of water for cooling. And so there's been a political fight within Utah to shut off the NSA's water. They're probably going to fail. But that's one of the interesting things about this whole scenario, which is that a national organization like the NSA has to exist in a state or Washington, D.C. And so they need resources from state governments. And so that is an interesting way to sort of put the brakes on NSA. We'll see if it goes anywhere. But this whole story of the NSA collecting images is the outrage du jour. And, you know, Harry McCracken, we were on Tech News Today, and I think we talked about the book No Place to Hide, which I think I had just started it when we were talking, and I've recently finished it. And that is a fascinating book. That was really an incredible book because he not only goes in and details the sort of story about how he was contacted by Edward Snowden. He kind of blew him off as a hack for many months because Snowden wanted him to install encryption. He's like, I don't have time to install encryption. And then the whole hotel room thing when they did the video and all that stuff, Glenn Greenwald was the person sitting there interviewing him. And then there's the whole sort of chase, cop and robber chase thing. And at the end, he gives the most fascinating parts of the psychological effects of surveillance on the public. Which is that if you know you're being watched, you change your behavior. You know, and that's the thing about, you know, the argument in favor of the NSA is they're not, you know, if you have nothing to hide, you know, it's okay. Don't worry about it. But the fact that we now know that they're surveilling us makes people, you know, stick to what they call, social norms of behavior instead of experimenting with things, trying things, and so on. So that's a fascinating book.
Did you come out of it liking Glenn Greenwald more? I find him a little, I admire him in some ways. I also find him to be somewhat grating because he spends so much time complaining about anybody and everybody who does not agree with him on everything.
Yep.
And I have not read the book partially because I'm a little intimidated by spending so much time with Glenn Greenwald.
Yep. He is, and that's one of the, you know, I guess his personality in general is why Edward Snowden picked him because he's a bit of a bulldog, as you point out.
Yes, I remember actually when Time did not name Edward Snowden as Person of the Year, Glenn Greenwald was appalled and said so incessantly. We named the Pope. I think there was also a good case for.
Yeah, the Pope is an unusual character as well, just like Glenn Greenwald and Edward Snowden. But you know, Glenn Greenwald is, as an editorialist yourself, you would appreciate. I think you'd come out of it with a similar view that I did, which is he makes a lot of good points, and it's definitely worth reading. He makes some faulty points as well. He's got some bad reasoning in there. For example, he's been in debates with people who say, oh, you know, surveillance is not, you know, that big of a deal. And so he's challenged them, okay, so why don't you tell us your phone number and your credit card number and all that kind of stuff. That's a bad argument, just from an argumentation standpoint, because there's a difference between the revelation of data that will have a 100% chance of being exploited in a negative way, which is when a person who's in favor of the NSA publicly gives their personal information, and the NSA when they're harvesting things, and chances are, you know, nothing that outrageous is going to happen. That's apple and oranges. That's a bad argument. But the rest of it is so interesting. I think it's worth reading, even if it is a flawed account. It's the best thing we've got, and it's really, you know, there are few books that have that many revelations, that much information about how the whole thing works.
When all is said and done, I think he's a force for good.
Yeah, I have to admit that I came out of it with a greater respect for Edward Snowden, about whom I've been on the fence. And I thought, you know, he's kind of a shameless, self-aggrandizing whatever. And then at the end of this book, I thought, you know, I guess the way to put it is that he's a more laudable person than I thought. What he's doing is braver than I thought it was, and a little bit more selfless than I thought it was. And so I came out with a better view of him, probably an identical view of Glenn Greenwald, who I like. I mean, you know, that's the whole point. You have somebody with strong opinions, and you can oppose them with opinions of your own, and he will attack you in the social media. So it's all fair. Well, speaking of the world of Cloak and Dagger, TrueCrypt had a weird termination this week. Essentially, what happened, TrueCrypt is one of the tools that Edward Snowden personally recommended that journalists use and other people use to escape the clutches of the NSA. And in fact, it's one of the ones that he wanted Glenn Greenwald to use before they had contact. But all of a sudden, you went to the TrueCrypt site and you got a redirect to a page that basically said, oh, TrueCrypt is not really that secure. You should use a Microsoft product, and never mind, we're going to go away. Goodbye. You know, this is a weird thing, and everybody thought it was a hack. But it turns out that it may not have been. This is just one of the most bizarre things I've ever said, but I guess one of the I've ever read. So, but one of the things that I wonder about is, does this make open source projects look bad? I mean, especially after Heartbleed.
I was going to say, Heartbleed, I think, did that.
Heartbleed did that, and now this is doing that. And, you know, it turns out, you know, nobody was, I don't think they got a lot of attention. You know, it was a tool. People used it or they didn't use it. They knew about it or they didn't know about it. Now we know all about it. And you know, the developers were anonymous. We don't even know what country they're in. We don't know if there's one of them or 100 people. We don't know if they work for the Chinese government. We don't know anything about
TrueCrypt. We don't know what their motivations for maintaining something. So let's say this is just as simple as they found a flaw that was so big. They do this in their spare time. There's no way they could tackle it in a responsible way, and they just walked away. Even if it's that simple, well, there's no safety net there.
Yeah.
You know, there's no accountability at all, like you said.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I mean, if a program does have flaws, I want to know about them, and I'm far more likely to know about them if it's open source.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the good and bad of open source. People can look inside of it.
Well, there's a group of people who are security researchers who want to continue TrueCrypt, and right now they're trying to see if they can get the rights to do that, as I understand it. And if they do, then they can sort of do a fork of TrueCrypt and bring it forward and have something like this continue. But it really raises the point that there's not a lot of choice in this kind of encryption, this kind of disk encryption. There really should be a lot more offerings out there that people can choose from. And, you know, we talked to Steve Gibson, who's who's the co-host of Security Now and, of course, has been in the industry for a long, long time. And he said he started to write something like TrueCrypt to do exactly that. And then he stopped because TrueCrypt was so good that he didn't think it was necessary. And he's now threatening to bring that off the shelf and keep developing it. So
maybe that's another challenge with open source, is that unless an open source project is adopted by a company that's aiming to really make a profit, there's not much incentive for competition. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to get redundancy built into an ecosystem if there's just sort of one open source product that takes care of everything.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the chat room is going nuts right now with TrueCrypt conspiracy theories.
I
should note that. This is obviously a topic people are very interested in. I think a couple of things that have come up just in some reporting around this, that people are very curious about the fact that an audit had been conducted was in the works for a few months before this whole thing shut down. And people are wondering if that has anything to do with it. Professor Green, who's doing that audit, I think, obviously had very good intentions for it, but people wonder what's happening there. And then also I did speak with a couple of folks in the security industry, including Dan Kaminsky, and I think a lot of people know who Dan is. He, I think in 2008, discovered a really big vulnerability in the DNS protocol. He has spoken a lot after Heartbleed, and then, of course, he has his own company that's doing sort of white hat security stuff. He said he had a completely crazy, the quote was, a completely crazy and baseless theory, which is always great, but that the software had to have been developed by somebody related to government, and he really does believe that that they put a stop to it, that the government figured out that people within a government organization had worked on this because, you know, they wanted to be anonymous the entire time. They never wanted to give the project over to anybody else, which often happens in open source things. Like, look at Bitcoin. The people who started it were anonymous, but eventually, you know, it's taken over by people who aren't anonymous, and it's maintained. And that never happened. And then sort of the weird references to Microsoft in the notice when it was taken down. So I just thought that I would throw that out for all of the folks watching right now who are really interested in trying to figure out why this happened, why it was taken down.
And you mentioned two weird references to Microsoft. One of those weird references was that they associated the termination of this project to the fact that Microsoft was not going to continue to keep XP going. And that's weird because it has nothing to do with XP at all. And it's also weird because, and we had a lot of conspiracy theories in the chat room when we talked about this on Tech News Today, because China the Chinese government banned Windows 8 for government use, using the same reason that XP was no longer being supported and therefore don't use Windows 8, which I guess the idea was that, oh, you know, in 15 years they won't support Windows 8 and we'll all still be using Windows 8 by then. And, you know, totally bizarre reason to do anything. And the other one was that the termination note explicitly recommended that everyone move to Microsoft, what is it called? I forgot what the name of it is, but Microsoft's encryption
is it BitLocker?
Like, BitLocker, that's it, BitLocker. Right. And, you know, we talked to Steve Gibson about that, and Steve said, no, that's not really the best choice at all.
Hmm. Yeah.
And it's controversial.
Kaminsky was like, nobody in this world would ever use BitLocker. Like, yeah. It's not on our radar.
Yeah, totally random. I mean, you'd expect better from the makers of TrueCrypt to make a better recommendation. So there are much better things out there. Well, you know, one of the things about all these NSA spying revelations is that you think, well, this is just the NSA is going nuts. They have unlimited resources. They're doing all these things. Another view is that they're just a leading indicator that the application of big data principles to the collection of internet-based stuff is kind of a no-brainer if you're an intelligence agency, and that the NSA is just doing what every national government would want to do. And it turns out that in Germany, there's a German report saying that the German version of the NSA wants to do something similar to what the NSA is doing, to do mass surveillance, and they've actually requested $400 million. I suspect it's going to cost more than that, $400 million. But they want to do something similar. And, of course, we've seen the allies of the United States, Britain, Canada, New Zealand, the English-speaking Australia, the English-speaking countries, essentially, who are all working in concert on a lot of this espionage stuff. But I think we're moving into a world where pretty much what the NSA is doing is a version of what everybody wants to do and will do, simply because their job is intelligence. And if the data is there, why not harvest it and store it?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think that if you're in the intelligence community and you're not doing, I'm not making excuses for this, but if that's your job and your goal is to find all the information, you're going to do whatever you can to achieve that, and maybe get a little too far away from the big questions about why we're doing it and whether it's the right thing to do. But you had better bet that other China's, I'm sure, of course they're doing this.
Yeah.
I would be shocked if they weren't. And in fact, I think there were quite a few people out there when all the NSA revelations started to come out who were, and I'm not sure this is a good thing, but the reaction was sort of like, well, are you surprised that the government is looking at your data? Didn't we all think that was happening anyway? So I don't know. I think that it's not too surprising to hear that other countries are trying to do the same thing.
Absolutely. And of course, the other thing that's interesting about this from a kind of, I guess, a political science perspective is that it's kind of giving espionage a bad name. What's wrong with espionage? We want our government to have information. Let's take an extreme case like North Korea. You have two choices. You can have espionage and learn things about what they're doing with their missiles and their rockets and their nuke program and their labor camps and all that stuff. Or you can voluntarily choose to have no idea what they're doing. I mean, those are really the options. And so we have espionage to spy on other countries to find out what they're doing. And, of course, this whole wiretapping communications thing goes way back. Back in the Cold War, the United States used to send submarines down to the bottom of the ocean and clamp these sort of like special purpose devices onto their underwater cables. And we'd listen to, you know, phone calls within Russia. This was probably in the 50s and 60s and 70s that the United States used to do this. There's, you know, they used to wiretap telegrams, you know, the telegraph system. And it turns out that the, you know, United States had this special, the NSA, in fact, had a relationship with all of the major telegraph companies to hand over data. It's just like today. And so this kind of thing has been going on for a long time. The problem with the NSA spying is that it's, in my opinion, clearly unconstitutional to harvest the data of people before they've been suspected of a crime, and everything, just do it preemptively, is a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, well, and history tells us that when we start to surveil our own people, especially people who are presumed innocent, that information gets misused over time. It
yes.
just does. It's the nature of power, is to find a reason to use those for the unintended purposes.
Yeah.
And today they can do it at scale. You know, I mean, like spying exactly. on one telegraph, probably not that huge a deal. Yeah. With the internet, it's just about as easy to spy on everybody as it is to spy on one person. And so by definition, you know, people who deserve their privacy are going to get caught up in it. And that was not true in the old days.
Yeah.
I think that this... first of all, when I read this story, I was really actually shocked that Germany was so far behind.
Yeah.
Because... I think it's been well documented that China, Iran, Israel, they're all doing what the NSA is doing and more. I mean, some would say that China's doing more. So I thought, okay, well, maybe Angela Merkel was just really upset that she can't listen on other people's cell phone conversations. She's going to catch up. But I think that all of these conversations have been really important, and Snowden has been very important. I talk to a lot of people who work in the security industry all the time, folks, you know, from places like Palo Alto Networks, as well as security researchers and hackers, and they really do believe that this is a conversation that had to happen around the NSA, but that nobody really, there was no motivation for it to happen. Nobody wanted to be the person to force the conversation, and the debate is going to change. I mean, this debate that we have with all these like ongoing revelations and more news coming out of Glenn Greenwald / Edward Snowden, and news stories like countries like Germany saying we need to start doing these things too, you'll see the security industry change and start to acknowledge and have to take into account our constitutional rights, which just hadn't happened since 9/11. I mean, there was kind of an after the terrorist attacks, like, it changed the conversation, and so we're going to see the pendulum swing back again.
You know, one of the things that... you know, again, espionage in general, in principle, can be a very, very good thing. And I think clearly with the NSA, the problem is a lack of oversight. One of the shocking things we learned from the Snowden revelations is that any analyst within the NSA above a certain level can simply call up an application and search everything, like searching Google. You know, then and maybe, you know, maybe they suspect their girlfriend is doing something, and they can just call it up and find out everything there is to know about this person. They absolutely can do that, and there's no checks on that. There's no external oversight, and there's not a whole lot of internal oversight within the NSA as well. So it's a really fascinating thing that we're all going to have to deal with. And of course, you know, it raises the question: are non-Americans protected by the Constitution? Is it okay to spy on people as long as they're not American citizens? And I think the world has been shocked by the conversation we're having in the U.S. This has gone constitutional. It's okay to do it for Germans. You can spy on Germans, just don't spy on me. So that's a kind of interesting development. So, you know, it's really a fascinating thing that, and I hope these revelations keep coming, because we really want to know a lot more about what's happening. And it's a great data story as well. The scale at which this thing is happening is just absolutely astonishing. So we'll keep an eye on that. Well, we're going to talk about what Microsoft is doing in just a sec, but we're going to take a break, and I want to tell you about one of our sponsors today, which is Personal Capital. One of the biggest barriers to getting ahead with your finances is understanding what's going on with your finances. How much are you really spending on everything? How much are you really saving? Are you on track with your retirement? Are you on track with your kids' college money? Where are you with all this stuff? We have accounts all over the place. They're all online nowadays. And so the way Personal Capital works is that you plug in all your different disparate financial accounts of all kinds, your bank accounts, your 401k, you name it, stocks, whatever it is that you have that's money related, you plug it in, and Personal Capital brings it to you on a single screen with charts and graphs that enable you to really have an intuitive understanding of what's happening with your money. It's very possible that what's actually happening with your money is a little scary, and it's good to know that now so you can plan ahead and make more intelligent decisions about how you're doing. It also shows you how much you're overpaying on the fees that you're paying, and it will guide you through reducing those fees. So it will not only let you get a handle on your finances, but it'll also actually materially save you money. So why wait? Signing up takes just a minute, and it pays big dividends. Personal Capital gives you total clarity and transparency to make your investment decisions right away. We've been using this. I started using this. My wife loves it. And it just really, just that picture of your total picture of your finances is priceless. So to set up your free account, go to personalcapital.com/twit. And remember that Personal Capital is free and the smart way to grow your money. You just go to personalcapital.com/twit and save your financial picture. Highly recommended. Well, Microsoft is doing some interesting things, including possibly, maybe, kind of, a smartwatch. This was an exclusive by Parmi Olson over at Forbes.com, and she says that Microsoft is working on a smartwatch. Not surprising that they're working on a smartwatch. Microsoft's the kind of company that might want to do that sort of thing. What was surprising was that her sources say that they could have something on the market by the end of the summer. I would be shocked if they did that. But does the world really want a, I guess, a Windows Phone-like smartwatch? Is it a good platform?
The reality is that I'm not sure the world really wants any smartwatches yet. I mean, we saw that spoof video a little while ago. I think that something will happen. Somebody will invent an aspect to smartwatches that will make them something you really feel like you need to own. But so far, I haven't seen that special feature quite yet. And in fact, we've been doing, Sharon Vakten, who works for CNET, has been doing some interesting tests on heart rate monitors. And even the heart rate functionality on most of these devices doesn't really work.
Yeah.
I mean, it works, but in under very certain circumstances, which is that you have to be holding perfectly stock still. And even then, they're not as accurate as, you know, an EKG or a chest-based heart band. It's so young, is what I'm saying.
So if you actually die, it's very accurate. It will say you're dead because you're holding still, right? So
yes, you have to be holding. Well, yeah, I mean, it'll say zero, yeah. Which would be accurate.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
I've been kind of stunned. We keep hearing about this revolution in biometrics, and everything is either a heart monitor or a pedometer. It's like enough already. Right. You know, my watch,
that's
my phone.
All that you can do. Unless you're going to work with the FDA, which none of these companies seem to want to do. You can't make any real medical claims, so you've got to be like, oh, we'll help you count your calories, lose some, you know, it's like, they're like the Weight Watchers of apps or something. It's like, we'll make promises, we don't have to keep them. So heart rate, pedometer, calories, you know.
Right.
I mean, until somebody actually works with the FDA to do something that really does something, it's a medical device that will make recommendations about your health that could hurt you or help you, you're just going to see all these like gimmicky things.
Well, and working with the FDA is an incredibly laborious, complicated process for very good reason. And I know this because this is really personal, but I have an insulin pump and a continuous blood glucose monitor that goes under my skin and feeds data about my blood sugar to this pump because I'm type 1 diabetic. And that technology is so not something you would want on your wrist. I mean, it is incredibly complicated. And just the layers of like tape and special kinds of adhesives that it takes to do that kind of thing is just very complicated. I think it's going to be a really long time until we get devices that are sort of both medically accurate and useful and things that you want to go, you know, over to Target and buy.
Yeah.
On your body.
Yeah.
Right? It's just a really complicated set of problems. So I think that whatever we get in a smartwatch is not, there may be some health aspects, right? Like the pedometer and the sort of general awareness of your activity. But there has to be something that's really not health-related that is the killer feature that we haven't quite seen yet.
I went to this Samsung event last week for their SimBand, which is like yet another Samsung wearable device, but really quite different than the Galaxy Gear stuff because SimBand is, in theory, this open platform for really futuristic wearable devices. And in fact, they want companies to invent new kinds of sensors. And I think they talked about blood glucose monitoring is a specific example. They want people to invent a technology that works for that. And so it's really intriguing. I've never thought of Samsung as the kind of company that would lead a open hardware platform, but at least they're giving it a try, and they conveniently announced it a few
right,
days
before
WWDC, which I'm sure was intentional.
I'm sure it was. Well, and Samsung has a medical devices business, right? I mean, Samsung is such a huge conglomerate in Korea. They have they've got their fingers in everything, right? Like, I think they make, you know, I think they make ships.
Yeah.
Right. So they do have an entire business against creating medical technology that I think that they're going to try to marry some of that with their consumer division.
Yeah. And the press photos of the prototype band, I guess, that they showed had, I don't know, what, 30 sensors on it. I mean, it was ridiculous. It had so many things in it. I mean, what are they sensing there? I mean,
the first one that they're shipping to developers later this year does not look all that exciting inherently. It's not radically different, but the idea is that it's a starting point for new technologies. One cool thing about it is they want to create a wearable device which you actually can wear 24/7, which generally speaking you can't because of battery issues. And they have like this little shuttle battery where you charge your battery and then you snap it onto your SIM band, and so you don't have to take your SIM band off.
That sounds like a cool innovation. They also announced a cloud service called Sammy.
Sammy.
And I understand that that's going to support you, non-Samsung devices may be able to use that. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's also, in theory, an open platform. And according to Samsung, at least, the great thing about Sammy is the consumer controls all the data. Mm-hmm. And there aren't any privacy issues because if it's part of Sammy, it's not going to be anything that anybody's going to try to monetize.
I've been stunned by the amount of attention that an association of medical-related and health-related things have been circulating around the smartwatch category. Apple, of course, has been hiring all these medical experts that have been seen on the campus and have been hired. And I just don't understand the attraction to that. It's just like, you know, like you say, Lindsay, it doesn't seem like that's the killer app. I think the real killer app for smartwatches is going to be, frankly, branding and design.
Oh, I totally agree. I think that they have to look beautiful and find a way. And I actually think that the killer feature with a watch is sort of the Google Cards experience, which we're going to see later in June at Google I.O. And I think we're going to see that on some devices. And I think that Google's really, I mean, this is where Google really shines, is their predictive abilities, right? Like, we know that you have an airline ticket sitting in your inbox and your watch is just going to flash up and say you need to leave the house in 5 minutes to catch your flight. I think that those sort of passive interaction is where it's really going to shine, because, or some really sophisticated voice recognition. But even that, you know, it would have to be at an arm's length to be really effective, so that it could just pick up on what you're saying, which is also creepy.
Yeah. And in fact, a Google executive posted some screenshots of Android Wear and showing a number of things, including a podcasting app and, you know, some a game even. That was interesting. And there was an unauthorized leak of a video showing an LG device playing Android Wear type stuff. And then that was yanked down unceremoniously by LG. That appeared on YouTube and then was taken down. I don't know if there are any illicit copies out there, but it looks pretty much like what you'd expect. And you know, I really do think that's really, I agree with you completely. It's a combination of really good notifications and great design. And you know,
one more point on why some of these hardware companies are all going after this the health space, which does seem totally counterintuitive. It doesn't make a lot of sense. There's one data point that we all might want to bear in mind, is that $1.9 billion in VC money went into digital health, mostly apps, software, and that's double from 2011. It's set to grow. So I've spoken with a lot of the venture capital guys about what they're investing in, especially the ones who've raised plus billion-dollar funds in the last two years. We did a story, you know, where are you going to put all this money? Digital health came up again and again and again. So I think some of these companies, Samsung, Apple, they don't know where it's going to go. They just know there's going to be a lot happening there in terms of apps and other devices around digital health as people try to figure this out. So to be able to be the platform for this space that's just receiving tons of money, double from 2011, they're almost $2 billion now, 2014 and 15, you're going to expect similar growth rates. It's not a terrible place to be when you look at it from that perspective.
Well, as a part of the healthcare industry, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if that if we got to a point, and I think it would take quite a while, but where these devices actually, you can get a prescription for one and get them underwritten by your insurance, and then they're part of the healthcare establishment. Yeah, that's a great place to be. There's a ton of money there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and there are a few companies out there doing stuff like that. Not very many. I think Proteus is probably the one that's furthest ahead.
Medical industrial complex, man, that is a great source of revenue, and it's insurable. Maybe we can get our watches covered and paid for by our health plans. Obamacare, we can do it. The website works. Well, Microsoft was not only potentially working on a smartwatch, they also showed off this week a sort of, I guess, a universal translator, Star Trek-style universal translator for our own planet that does instant translation via Skype. So you can have a Skype call with somebody, and you can speak English, according to their demo, and the person on the other end can hear what you said in German and also read it on the screen, and then they speak German to you, and then you hear in English what they said. It's a kind of a no-brainer. It seems like the kind of thing Google would do as well. But this is fantastic technology making the world a better place, unless there's something about it that I don't...
I watched the demo, and of all of this, you know, conversation about wearables and iBeacon, you know, this is the thing that got me the most excited this week. I found it just amazing. And even, I'm sure there's a long way to go. I mean, this is one demo with just German and English. I thought it was funny that they picked those languages. I mean, English, but German? Okay.
They've previously demonstrated, I think, Mandarin or standard Chinese translation. I think a year or two ago, there was a famous demo of that.
Right.
But
I found it incredibly compelling because this is a real challenge. I mean, I've heard people in the software development industry who worked really closely with companies in India recently have been pulling back, partially just because of, and that's just English, those are other English speakers, but partially because of communication issues, mostly having to do with time zones. But if you can imagine the ability to work just seamlessly across languages, I don't know. I think it's a huge economic opportunity, and it's also just fascinating. Cool to see.
Truly is. And my wife and I were recently living in Italy. We spent some weeks living in Florence, Italy, and I was carrying around the what's called WordLens, I believe it's called. Mm-hmm. It's an app that
translates
for
the image.
Phone. Right, exactly. And I had Google Glass. So this is the first worldest problem you can imagine. I had Google Glass, and I was saying, man, why don't they have this for Google Glass? This would be so great. Poor me. And so you hold this thing up to a sign or a menu or something that's written in some foreign language, in this case Italian, and it would show you in English in the same typeface with the same colors and everything. It felt really magical, like truly amazing. And this is the world we're going to, where that sort of thing will be in your smart glasses. And tourists, you'll be able to walk around, and no matter what country you're in, everything's in English for you. That's going to be standard. Like, we're on the brink of that world. And then when you talk, you know, you're going to hear in your ear the language. When people talk to you, you're going to hear English, and then you can talk, and they're going to hear their language. It's really going to make the world a smaller place. And I've already taken advantage of the translation feature built into Google Plus, talking to a lot of people in a lot of countries, and you just click a button and boom, you see English. It's just, I agree with you. This is a great new world that we're going to be living in. You know, people talk.
I love it. A real life babblefish. It's like the answer really is 42.
Exactly.
It's great.
That's exactly right. And so it's you know, people talk about wearables as being invasive and annoying, and it's true. But, you know, things like smart glasses can really, you know, enable you to break down language barriers.
I mean, on the other hand, I guess to play the devil's advocate against my own excitement, I love other languages. I don't speak any of them very well, but I love learning them to the extent that I can. I think, and I feel the same sadness when I think about a future in which I don't need to learn another language that I feel when I think about a future in which I don't need to drive.
Yep.
There's a joy in driving. There's a joy in learning another language that I just sort of on a human level worry about losing, because I feel like language is the fabric of your society and it's closely linked to your culture.
But, you know, but if you really want to get depressed, you really want to go down this rat hole. A foreign language is knowledge. What do we need knowledge for? I mean, why learn knowledge? Why learn facts if any fact can be conjured up instantly 24/7.
Well, somebody's got to put it on the internet.
Yeah.
Also, it's going to be a long, long time before a computer can translate between languages as well as a human who gets fluent at it. I mean, it's like a lot of other technologies. The first 80% is relatively easy. And the last 20% that really does make it magical is the hard part. And
yep.
you do get there sometimes. I feel like voice recognition kind of got there after many years where voice recognition was amazing, but not quite amazing enough to actually be practical. It actually is. And but translation is nowhere near that.
But it raises, I think, a serious issue for education. What do you teach kids? Do you teach them a foreign language now, as you said? Do you teach them to do cursive writing? Do you teach kids to be able to function without a smartphone that's connected to the internet?
So the cursive writing question is really interesting. And I think lately I have a fifth grader, soon to be sixth grader, who did learn cursive, and his school district does teach it. And part of the motivation for cursive, a lot of schools have not been teaching it anymore, is that for kids who have dyslexia or any sort of trouble writing or interpreting, cursive helps. It actually forces the two sides of the brain to talk to each other, and they can spell better in cursive. I've seen this with my own child. It's very interesting. So there are some skills, I think, that we don't know what they have until we stop doing them. And then we realize, oh, we lost something there, and maybe we should bring it back a little bit.
Yeah. You know, I think we've already lost so much. I mean, it used to be, you know, 200 years ago, kids would need to know how to milk a cow, and they would need to do all these things which kids nowadays have trouble even recognizing what a cow is. And so, you know,
this, not in Petaluma.
Not in Petaluma. But you know, this is the trajectory we're on, and it's accelerating because of digital technology. And, you know, in the education market, we have to decide what we're going to teach kids.
I also have I find this fascinating, but I think that because of voice recognition, because it's become so sophisticated, there is a possible future in which we don't need to write at all.
Right.
We speak. And maybe you go in there and edit, but you're wearing a smart glass, you're wearing some sort of receiver, you simply speak what it is that you want to communicate, it comes out written, you can read. Everybody will need to read, but I think that there is a possibility that we'll get to a point where cursive or print, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who dictate entire books.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody who dictates all of his emails and all of his correspondence, and then a lot of his memos to his staff and reports. And he said that because of where the technology is, he actually has to speak like a robot for it to work. So he couldn't have the sort of conversation we're having with natural inflection. He actually has to sound like a robot, and that he does it for 4 hours a day. And when he comes out, it's confusing for his staff because they don't know what's happened to him, you know. And there were definitely people who would work with him and didn't know him well, who'd only see him in these moments and think that he had like some very severe form of autism. And he was like, it's weird how the technology is changing our personalities and the way we interact. And yeah. It's bizarre.
It is bizarre. And you know, I've tried to use, I don't know if you've tried this before, Harry, to sort of like dictate columns and things like that. It's great at first, and then you just get tired of it, and it alters your thinking process.
It's just different. I've read books, actually, even before voice recognition, there were people who would dictate books onto tapes and have them transcribed, and I've read a fair number of books that weren't all that great that were dictated, because when you write, you polish and edit and think carefully. And I think for most people, that's harder to do when talking out loud.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of books, we're going to talk in just a second about Amazon's war against one major publisher. But first, I think, Chad, don't we have a look at what happened here in the TWIT Brick House this week? Here's what happened right here at TWIT.
Previously on TWIT.
Oh, crap. Apple just bought Beats.
Did they?
Tech news tonight.
Apple confirmed it is indeed buying Beats Electronics for $3 billion.
Tech news today.
Visitors to the TrueCrypt site were redirected to a page in the open source community site SourceForge, advising users to stop using the product and switch to Microsoft BitLocker.
See, was a hack, it was an absolute breach of all of the previous security, which really is a stretch.
Security Now.
Basically, what Title II does, it would try to regulate the internet as if it was a 19th century telephone company. The rules don't fit at all.
TWIT. Great tech news and analysis every day.
It just doesn't make sense from my point of view, but obviously it makes sense to Apple, so.
I have what you said about it on
Twitter. Go ahead.
Rewind.
It was a rumor created by Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine in an attempt to sell headphones and stock or whatever.
This was 17 days ago, Chad.
Some interest in a company that is actually failing.
All right.
Actually, I asked him to make a recording because I thought, you know, if it really does happen, then you can mock me endlessly.
That's outrageous. I did not say that. This has been digitally inserted. Sorry, Leo. I'm going to lose my job. Amazon, we're talking about the future of books. Amazon had a weird glitch with some Hachette books recently where if you went to try to pre-order some Hachette books, you couldn't. And it turns out that Amazon had been negotiating with Hachette over something, presumably the price of the books that Hachette was publishing. And a lot of people cried foul saying, you know, okay, you're using your quasi-monopoly to sort of like crush these publishers into, you know, bending them to your will. And this is outrageous. And then they came out with a rare statement saying, no, look, we're here to negotiate on behalf of the customers who want the lowest possible prices. And we don't know if we're going to be offering these books in the future because the negotiations aren't going so well. And so why should we take pre-orders if, you know, if we might not be selling these books? We may be terminating our relationship with Hachette and they may have to go to the other Amazon, wherever that is. So where do you fall on this? Where do you guys fall on this? Is this a case of a monopoly sort of dominating an industry and making everybody do it things their way? Or is this just a reasonable negotiation and the effect of that negotiation reflected in the catalog itself?
Well, I don't know if I can say whether or not it's reasonable because you'd have to be there to know what the actual arguing is about. What we do know is that this has been going on for some months. And I think it was the New York Times that pointed out that that most of these negotiations happen within a month, right? This has been taking a while. You know, I think that this, at the very least, shows how important Amazon has become, right? It would make logical sense that they take down the pre-order button if they think that their negotiations may fall through. But I think the entire world cries foul because they're like, the negotiations aren't going to fall through. What would Hachette do if they didn't have Amazon? And that question right there is why people get so upset.
Right. How do you function as Hachette without Amazon? I mean,
the part I find fascinating is not the negotiations between Amazon and Hachette, because they're both big companies. This stuff happens all the time. It's the fact that Amazon has always called itself Earth's most customer-centric company, and for the most part it is. I mean, the level of customer service they offer is kind of astonishing, but they've acknowledged that not only are they not taking pre-orders, but they're also keeping fewer copies on hand. They're intentionally delaying shipments in some cases. Essentially, customers are getting caught in the crossfire. And of course, every company they weigh decisions and they do things that end up not being as perfect for the customers as they might be. But Amazon has such a history of doing things that sometimes seem crazy that make life better for its customers, that to sort of have the curtain peeled back and to see them basically willingly not letting people get the books they want because of this, I think is kind of shocking in a way it would not have been if it was Walden Books or whoever.
They remind me a bit, Katie Benner, of Walmart, which is that, yes, people want lower prices. They want things a certain way. And so we, Walmart, are going to use our gigantic power in the industry to force everything to happen our way. We're going to change the way people package their products. We're going to change the way they ship them. We're going to definitely lower the price. And having everybody buy everything from Walmart is good for customers. Is Amazon that in a nutshell? I mean, I'm sure you've heard about the diapers.com scenario where Amazon has this algorithm that automatically changes prices based on what the competitors' prices are. And they undercut diapers.com consistently over a sustained period of time to the point where the valuation of diapers.com crashed, and then they bought it at the lower price, and now they own diapers.com. Is that good for customers? What do you think, Katie? Is Amazon a force for good or evil?
Well, I don't know if they're a force for good or evil, but I think that Amazon being good for customers is kind of a nice whitewash or veil for Amazon to be good for Amazon. And I think the diapers.com example is great. And I think that your Walmart analogy is very interesting because Walmart is a very, very low margin business. You know, they have to do volume because they do not have margins. Amazon's similar. As we know, Amazon, when you look at their P&L every quarter and they put out their annual report, this is not a money-making company. So it was very fascinating. I think it was also the New York Times that had an editorial or a news analysis around this issue saying that they thought that it was interesting that this battle happened at a time when Wall Street investors were finally starting to get a little bit restless with Amazon about not being able to produce profits despite all of these sprawling businesses and everything that it does. And in that statement from Amazon, essentially what the company said was, we're playing the long game here. We need to deal with publishers like Hachette in a way that's going to be good for customers, but at the end of the day, good for Amazon. And the New York Times posited that maybe Amazon realized they needed to start building margins somewhere, because you can't just run, you know, 50 different low margin businesses unless you can do Walmart type volume in all of them, which they don't quite yet.
Yeah, the low margin approach to business is yet another questionable thing that sounds, if you look at it from a certain perspective, as an anti-competitive thing. For example, Amazon famously sells books at below the cost that they paid for them. And, you know, they essentially say, well, you know, we think this book is going to be a $9.99 book. If they negotiate a price that's higher than that from the publisher, they still sell it at $9.99. This is what got Apple into trouble when they colluded with other publishers to keep margins high so that publishers could actually make money and so on. Turns out that that's illegal. But what they call dumping, if you do it internationally, it's dumping. If you sell something below cost in another country, that's against the international rules of trade. But if you do it domestically, it's okay. And Amazon does that. They also did that with some of their tablets, where they were reportedly selling tablets at lower cost than it took them to make, with the intention of making it up later for selling things, because essentially an Amazon tablet is basically a cash register for Amazon.com. So it's really hard to get your brain around whether Amazon should have a more profitable business, where they should be kinder and gentler. It's almost impossible to imagine them that way. And I think one of the reasons they've come into a lot of criticism lately is Alibaba is in the news. Alibaba is sort of kind of the Chinese Amazon. Not really. They have different models, very different models. But they're essentially, they dominate the Chinese buying things online scene in a similar way that Amazon does within the United States. And Alibaba is massively profitable. They make lots of money. They have rock bottom prices on some of their categories, some of their stores. They have different types of stores, but they have like 40% of their revenue is profit or some, and I'm making these numbers up, but it's very, very high. So I don't know. I doubt that with Jeff Bezos in charge, they're ever going to soften and become a,
I don't think so. And he has said over and over and over again that they're there for the long haul, right? That all the decisions he makes are so that they can build the business that they want to build for, you know, 15 or 20 years from now. Which is very interesting. It's you would almost expect them to be softer with that approach, but they seem to be just extremely rigid and dogmatic. And it's just, I don't think we'll know for 10 years if they're being good or evil.
Yep.
Just talking about books specifically, I would be happier if there was somebody who seemed like a true arch rival to Amazon in that category, because Barnes & Noble, you know, is not an arch rival. They're really in somewhat difficult shape.
Yeah.
And despite Apple getting into trouble, the iBook store is not an arch rival to Amazon for eBooks. And the day will come when Amazon does have an arch rival, because it always happens. But right now, it's a little hard to see how that happens because they are so powerful.
Or yeah. There will be an antitrust investigation.
Right.
I mean, that could it really could happen. I mean, you think about it, Amazon has, if they get up to 70% market share, and they basically have the entire self-publishing market, which is of their own design, really not, that's not necessarily a negative thing. It's a positive thing in some ways, but that's a huge.
Yeah, from an antitrust perspective, though, they're squeezing the publishers at one end, and then they're competing directly with them with an entirely different model on the other end.
Exactly.
It's not easy to be a publisher.
And there was a small publisher or two has come out in favor of Amazon and this, and there are stories about small publishers reaching way more people and doing very well because of Amazon. So I certainly don't think they're an ogre who is only bad for the publishing business. In some ways, they have been wonderful for publishing.
Well, I think we can all agree on this, which is that Jeff Bezos is a genius and that Amazon is an incredibly disciplined company. And that's the source of their success in a very brutal market. As far as I'm concerned, if they deliver diapers via drone, all is forgiven. That's all I want. Is that too much to ask? Well, in a sec, we're going to talk about another company with a bad reputation, Comcast. But first, I want to tell you about Carbonite, a company that saved my personal bacon many, many times. Carbonite is an automatic backup solution that backs everything up into the cloud, and you really don't have to do anything. That's one of the really cool things about Carbonite. They were the first company, the first backup company that just took all of the necessity of having any sort of technical acumen or basically foresight about backing up your files, and they just did it automatically. I first started using this back when I was a Windows user, and on the Windows version, you just install it, and it figures out which files you pretty much want to back up. And then it puts a little circle next to every single file in your entire system that tells you whether we're not going to ever back this up, we are going to back this up but haven't backed it up, we have already backed this up, so don't worry about this file. It's so reassuring. Unfortunately, that little user interface feature doesn't exist on the Mac version, but the Mac version, because of the way that the Mac is established, it's Apple's fault, not Carbonite's. But essentially, it's still that easy. You simply install it, then the default mode is that everything's just backed up into the cloud. And then when a meteor shower destroys your house and breaks your laptop into multiple pieces, you haven't lost any data, so you don't have to worry. And so Carbonite is really a fantastic service that I've been using for many, many years. It backs up all your computers, and not only that, just servers, external hard drives, whatever it is, into the cloud. You know, it's probably a good idea to have a local copy as well, a little hard drive, because sometimes it's easy to, you know, you may not have an internet connection, you may need a file or whatever. It's good to have redundancy, but you definitely need that cloud-based backup because, you know, you don't want all your stuff together. There's the famous story of the film producer of Apocalypse Now. What is his name? Harry, you have an encyclopedic knowledge of all Hollywood wisdom. Anyway, the
Francis Ford Coppola?
That's the guy. Francis Ford Coppola was in Argentina, and he had his screenplay and all of his personal photographs on a laptop, but he was backing them up to a hard drive right next to the laptop. The laptop was stolen, the hard drive was stolen, and he had nothing. He lost the screenplay, he lost the pictures, and that is, he's now the poster child for why you need cloud backup. So start your free trial today at Carbonite.com. No credit card required at all. You can just start using it without a credit card. Use the offer code TWIT, and you get free bonus months, two of them, two free bonus months if you decide to buy. That's Carbonite.com and the offer code TWIT. Well, let's talk about Comcast, because Comcast is getting a lot of bad press lately, and they've been embroiled in this all these controversies around net neutrality. And, you know, making matters worse, the CEO of Comcast, Brian Roberts, recently came out and said, we're going to tell you why everybody hates Comcast. The reason everybody hates Comcast is when the people that originate the Comcast, the data, the sort of Netflix of the worlds and the YouTubes, when they raise their prices, everybody blames us. We're just trying to provide a good service, and therefore we think that we're like the post office. If you want to ship a package through the post office, you got to pay the post office. And he's saying that he thinks that companies that generate a lot of data, like Netflix, should be paying them, and paying them quite a bit for the data, even though the customers are also paying for the delivery of that data. Any thoughts? Has he got a good point here?
Well, the reason that came off as so silly is because I don't think that's the reason that people hate Comcast at all. They hate it because they don't like dealing with the customer service when they call up because there's a problem with their cable. It takes forever. You're stuck at home. There are all kinds of reasons. I think that's the last of them.
Yes, exactly.
Do you hate Comcast, Katie?
Nobody cares about what's happening with Netflix in terms of like whether or not we like the company. It's exactly that. They're horrible to their customers, bad customer service. But in terms of, you know, what Roberts is saying too, it almost feels like he kind of wants to have it all ways. He's like, we're just the pipe, and so you just pay the pipe. We're just the pipe. But he also wants to be able to control the pipeline, and he wants to not be a dumb pipe, and he wants to be more than just the interchange, and he wants to preserve a gatekeeper role too. And I don't really think he can have it all ways.
And he owns lots of content, Yeah, he's not a dumb pipe. He's a dumb pipe that owns NBC and does all kinds of stuff and makes movies.
I personally would love to live in a world where the pipes are as dumb as they could possibly be, but just really fast. And mm-hmm. I'd love to get content from a company. You know, Google Fiber, which is only in two towns right now, and they're looking at more towns. But that's probably as fast as it gets in the United States for the delivery of content. But Google's not a disinterested party. They want you to get their
YouTube
ads as fast as you can possibly get.
Well, they want you to get YouTube.
Well, YouTube is the second biggest generator of data after Netflix in the United States. And, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so I would – I just – there's got to be some way other than just having these things become common carriers, where we can just have the dumbest pipes that have no interest other than providing the fastest possible data service.
Sadly, there is no such thing as a disinterested large company.
I guess I'm just a dreamer.
Well, it could be government regulated, but there are a lot of people who wouldn't want that either. And Australia tried to do that, and that fell apart.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are some countries, a few of them, South Korea, but really, I mean, that's the alternative.
Yeah, absolutely.
And right. It raises the question, has the internet risen to the level of importance that it's a utility and it should be treated like utility? And if that's the case, well, then that's very different. But until that happens, we're stuck with Brian Roberts.
Yeah. Well, and we shouldn't be. The real problem, the root problem, whenever we talk about net neutrality, whenever we talk about whether we hate Comcast or not, is that there's often not much of an alternative to Comcast, as there are in other countries. You go to the UK and you can choose from among 4, 5, 6, 7 different ISPs and, you know, let the best ISP win. And we don't have that here. In some markets, it's just one. In others, it's two. It's very rarely more than 3 or 4. And that's really the problem. And we need to figure out how to get some competition in this market. I think we can all agree with that. Well, that is TWiT. That is today's TWiT, the Leo-less version here. And before we sign off, I want to invite everyone to tune in to our special coverage tomorrow of the WWDC Developers Conference keynote. And that's going to be Leo Laporte. He's in the basement tied up right now. We're going to untie him for that. Sarah Lane, Alex Lindsay, and me, and we're going to cover it live. We're going to heckle the keynote and see what it is that they announce tomorrow. So tune in for that. Tech News Today, which is normally at 10 o'clock, is going to be at 8:30 a.m. Pacific. So Harry McCracken, I want to thank you for coming on TWiT today. It's always a pleasure to have you on whatever show I happen to be hosting.
Always good to see you, Mike.
And so tell us more about where people can read your stuff with your new joint.
Sure. Well, come to technologizer.com and you'll see all my stuff. Or I'm Harry McCracken at Twitter. I'm also doing Technologizer on Flipboard. You can find my Technologizer magazine there, which will have all my stuff.
I didn't know that.
I just started doing that.
I'm going to subscribe to that.
I love Flipboard, and I figure why not make the experience as good as possible?
Why not? So it's always great to have a good source of content there. Some of the stuff on Flipboard is not great, but I'm sure yours is going to be awesome. Is that just going to be your stuff, or are you going to curate?
I'm going to curate, too. In fact, I'm curating on Technologizer.com, too, and the stuff I curate there I'll also curate on Flipboard.
All right, wonderful. Well, thank you for coming on to TWiT. And Lindsay Turrentine, Editor-in-Chief of CNET Reviews, thank you for coming on to TWiT.
You're welcome. Very fun.
And so tell us more about this, a little bit more about this this secret lab that you have for home automation. This is going to be generating all kinds of, like, reviews of these products?
Well, we actually have this now. We have a 12,000-square-foot facility in Louisville, Kentucky. It's a warehouse that we've converted into an editorial space and a testing facility where we test large appliances and small connected appliances. And we rate them and review them like all of the other technology that we review on CNET. So that's great. There's some exciting additional stuff we'll be doing that I can't talk about quite yet, but will be coming in the fall.
Awesome. Wonderful. And Katie Benner with the information. Thank you so much for coming on to Tech News. Tech News Today.
Thanks,
this isn't Tech News
really
Today.
Fun.
This is TWiT. This is This Week in Tech. This is the big show, but thank you for coming on. And where can people find what you write?
We are theinformation.com. It's a subscription site. It's true, but I think it's worth subscribing, and I hope that you do join us over at The Information.
The most important part of that URL is the word the. Information is easy to remember, but don't forget you have to use the word the. The Information. Well, thank you so much, Katie Benner. And this has been an exciting adventure for me personally, doing this show. I remember I used to be right where you're sitting right in that chair, looking at Leo do This Week in Tech and thinking, there's no way I could do that. There's no way I could do that show. I don't know how he does it, and I still don't know how he does it. But it's been exciting for me, and I want to thank you all for coming. And so I get to say what Leo always says, another TWiT is in the can. Always wanted to say that.